From the Lost Pianos of Siberia website. Sophie Roberts says, The Lost Pianos of Siberia is a non-fiction book charting my search for an instrument in Siberia worthy of a brilliant Mongolian pianist. For more than 2 years, I travelled the Siberian hinterland, the far north, and the Russian far east. I not only found historic pianos, but also tales of people who survived extraordinary hardship in pursuit of music's profound beauty, which does beautifully as an intro. Sophie Roberts is an English travel writer whose focus is on remote parts of the world, where she can report on wildlife conservation, threats to ecosystems, and fragile cultures. She's been an editor-at-large for Condé Nast Traveler, a travel editor for The Economist, and a columnist for the Financial Times. The Lost Pianos of Siberia is her first book. Hi, Sophie.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on with us. You are so intrepid. You were born with the wanderlust. You come from a sort of wanderlusty family. How did that start?
Well, I was born in Scotland, and I was born in a place and at a time where I didn't really get to travel. I think my first foreign trip was when I was 15. I was born on a farm. My father farmed trout. And, you know, we had a wild and rural childhood. But as soon as I could afford a flight ticket, I was out of there to try and find something of the world for myself.
Instead of trout, I would track pianos. No, I'm misquoting you. Instead of tigers, I would track pianos. But the trout intrigued me. Did he make money from it just quickly?
No, not really.
No, okay.
He was also a writer, and my father's still alive. He's a wonderful writer. But there's a wonderful quote from one of the great Siberian travelers of all time, the playwright Anton Chekhov, who traveled the full 5,500 miles from Moscow all the way to the shores of the Pacific, to Sakhalin Island. This was in 1890, and all his friends in Moscow were asking, why would you leave the great fashionable salons of Moscow and St. Petersburg to go off to some miserable place on the other side of the world? And he said this, even assuming my excursion is an utter triviality, a piece of obstinacy and caprice, let me tell you what I'll be losing by going. Time, money. My time costs nothing. I've never had any money anyway. And that's kind of at the core of my motivation as well.
Like Chekhov, I remember that quote in the book. The idea behind finding a piano that had aged along with Siberia, something more soulful than a Yamaha, at first hearing, that is a strange notion. So how did the idea of finding a piano and the determination that followed that come to be?
Well, I was spending quite a lot of time in Mongolia. I'm a journalist, and I'd been working there. I'd come and gone maybe four or five times. And I'd got to know one particular family in the Orkhon Valley, which is an incredibly special part of Mongolia. It's a German gentleman married to a Mongolian lady, and they had three children. And the daughter was a keen amateur pianist. And they had a young woman in their lives who was teaching their daughter piano. And she is a remarkable, remarkable pianist in her own right. And the German gentleman has helped her train in Italy over the years. And I got to meet her. And I heard her play on this Yamaha in a tent, what they call a ger in Mongolia, beside a silver river snaking through this huge, vast steppe country. I mean, it's magical. You know, you see the stars above, there's no lights, nothing. And you hear a piano playing. And I was transported. I was in a completely magical place. And this gentleman, the German gentleman, leaned over to me and he said, the sound is not quite right. If only she had one of the lost pianos of Siberia. And you can't throw a phrase out like that to somebody like me and not pique some kind of interest. So that grew. And I started to look at what was behind that throwaway phrase. And it turned out that at the time when European Russia was beginning to effectively colonize Asiatic Siberia, the piano was moving from St. Petersburg and Moscow, where it became an incredibly fashionable instrument, a sort of sign of enormous sophistication. They called it a civilizing piece of furniture. It made you look rather grander than you might be in truth. And these pianos started to move into Siberia with governors, adventurers, exiles, all sorts, against all odds. You know, they'd be carried on sledges, these huge unwieldy instruments. And I loved both the absurdity and the poetry of that. And the fact there was some history to back up my kind of crazy quest to go and see if I could find an instrument with a slightly deeper historic sound for this pianist. It didn't really matter if it was going to succeed or fail, but there was surely going to be great adventure in the doing.
Obvious question before we proceed. Did Chopin and Tchaikovsky and Bach and whomever sound better on these old pianos?
Okay, so this is a really interesting question because I need to be very clear. I'm not a musician, and I listened to pianos that sounded like my fingers being pulled down a blackboard. I could tell that much. Other times you heard a sort of song in a piano. You could hear a sort of a different voice, and maybe, again, the storyteller in me was interested by the narratives that had kept these pianos safe and protected against all odds, whether that was climatic or political or whatever it might have been. They had a song. So I was always looking for that song, which was a confluence of both story and also sound.
The Silver River snaking through. You know, you write so prettily that for the first time talking to authors, I thought fleetingly of getting you to read a passage, even that first page of your book as you take the train from Moscow towards the Ural Mountains, and I settled into that world of yours, your quest, right away. But I shan't ask you that. But there is no sign, I will ask you about this, there is no sign saying welcome to Siberia, is there? There never has been.
There used to be a post, actually, that was there's a wonderful painting by a Polish artist which has all the exiles sort of weeping in the shadows of this pillar. But that's now gone. There is no sign, and nor should there be, because Siberia is both a place and it's an idea. It's almost a country, but it's not quite. I will have many, many naysayers who read this book and disagree fundamentally with the way that I've defined Siberia, because I've taken it in its widest possible, most poetic terms, which is somewhere. It begins somewhere in Ekaterinburg, and it ends goodness knows where. And that's a phrase I took from Chekhov, and it justified it perfectly, because Siberia is a metaphor. It's a word that induces all kinds of responses. It's the worst table in the restaurant in New York City. Huh? You know, it's so many things. But is it really just a stereotype? And that was really a key part of my quest. I like to puncture or at least investigate the stereotypes. And I wanted to see if Siberia was something more than what one particular historian has brilliantly described as the largest continental prison without a roof.
More prosaically, it is. And I didn't really know this. I found it a startling stat. 1/11 of the world's land mass.
Yes, yeah. If you take it on the terms that I experienced it, which was, as I say, the Urals to the Pacific, and yeah. I included Kamchatka in that. Yeah, it's huge. And, you know, a lot of travellers experience it via the great, iconic and wonderful Trans-Siberian Railway, which was built at the turn of the last century. And it's an amazing thing. It's a feat of engineering, and it opened up this great hinterland of Russia. But my goodness, what lies above and below that thin line of rail is the part of Siberia that really truly excited me, the roadless part of Siberia. I mean, even Kamchatka, which is the peninsula that comes off into the Pacific, is the bit that is on the board game Risk, is the best place to make an attack on North America, I believe. But it's this wonderful kind of finger of volcanoes, 500 volcanoes, I think that's right, sort of stretching down this bit of coast. And there's no road connecting that peninsula to mainland Russia,
yeah.
But it's a peninsula, and that's incredible. So, you know, traveling that part of the world for those reasons make it really exciting, because you have to think, you have to be opportunistic, you have to make friends. It's not just a train journey, and that excited me.
Remote, inaccessible, ideal for exile and punishment, and of course become synonymous with that as well. And early on in your book, it's the sheer nastiness of those exiles. It wasn't just hard yards in the gulags. you know, terrible things happened to people, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, it is a very, very dark history, and that story is very well told. And the suffering and the untold and never to be known stories are far larger than the ones that have reached us today, for sure. This is the Tsarist period. The Gulag period, the Soviet period, is a slightly different narrative. A lot of people moved to Siberia through free will. They wanted to get far from the reach of the Tsar and from the strictures of the Orthodox Church. And Siberia, to people, I'm sure some of your listeners, is wilderness can be a very powerful thing. It can be something you run towards, not run away from. And there was also a sort of humanity that evolved in Siberia because people were conscious of the trail of men and women and children marching in a line of chains to this god-awful, god-forsaken world where they were going to die. And they would leave bread on windowsills and something to drink. And that kind of spirit of hospitality is so pronounced. It just, I don't know, maybe I was over-romanticizing it, but it feels, it's got a really, really deep spirit of hospitality in Siberia. And I felt that really strongly. You knock on a door and people make you feel at home. And I think that that is a legacy of a kind of empathy that evolved through these poor, desperate people that should never have ended up there in the first place. You could be sent to Siberia for taking snuff. I think it's one of the stories I've come across.
Yeah, and all sorts of very unpleasant things would happen to you, depending on what you had done. The Lost Pianos of Siberia, we're talking with Sophie Roberts. Russia's relationship with the piano began with Catherine the Great.
Yes, I mean, Catherine the Great is where I begin the story because I encountered a really interesting piano which she commissioned in out of London in 1774. It's a piano that survives. It's a square piano, and it was when the instrument was, you know, still nothing like the instrument we know today, but the principles were in place. She was a great Anglophile. The gardeners, the architects, everything, anything English. And she was of enormous wealth, and she wanted to be the most fashionable, sophisticated country in the world. And so she bought not only pianos, but she bought wonderful musicians, composers, and she made sure that her son and daughter-in-law went off to hear Mozart and Clementi play this spectacular and very sort of epoch-defining duel in, I think it was Vienna. And it was, so she started something, but she had people around her who were truly convinced that the royal court needed such things, like Potemkin, who was her most famous lover and advisor. And he would send his courier to Milan to fetch a piece of sheet music. You know, he had to have a choir with him at all times. Catherine, in her sort of witty way, would say, "Oh, I'm deaf as a post." But I'm not so sure she was, because of the legacy that began under her and really took off in the beginning of the 19th century. John Field, a wonderful Irish composer, he turned up in St. Petersburg and followed quickly by the great virtuosos of the 1820s to the 1840s. So Franz Liszt, you know, he set St. Petersburg alight. There's wonderful descriptions of it. It sounds like a modern day rock concert, with people flinging things in the hope that they might be able to touch a piece of this kind of demonic genius.
I know. Liszt leaving Berlin for Russia in the spring of 1842. Fantastic stuff. It was like a rock star, the biggest rock star in the world arriving, wasn't it? How did it in the 18th century give ordinary Russians a taste of liberty? There were the serf orchestras, weren't there?
Under Catherine, we're talking about keyboard instruments, we're talking about early pianos. The strongest, richest musical tradition at the time were these serf orchestras. And it was, you'd have, you know, the serf system being effectively the slave system. And as the great noble families of Russia became more and more ambitious and more interested in the culture of Europe, which was bristling with new ideas, they would send up their serfs to get trained. And there's a wonderful story told about a group of musicians that went to Leipzig. And there was two of them came back and they tasted freedom in Leipzig. not just the sounds of beautiful music. So when they got back, they chopped their master up into little pieces in the bedchamber. I think they probably ended up in Siberia. I didn't track it any further.
That's a story and a half. Why were pianos, though, sent to Siberia for safekeeping?
During the Second World War, what the Russians called the Great Patriotic War, there were huge evacuations done of some of the most precious parts of the country's culture. And thank goodness for that, including, in fact, that piano of Catherine the Great's, the 1774 Zumpe she'd purchased out of London, which was one of my most exciting bits of research, actually. I got enormous help from a museum in Petersburg and traced it to its hiding place, its safe house during the war, which was Novosibirsk, which is the de facto capital, I suppose, of Siberia. But it has the largest opera house in Russia. And during the war, it was under construction. And this piano, along with a whole host of other treasures, were stored in the basement and other parts of this unfinished opera house. You know, a lot of things got taken to Siberia during the war. The prima ballerinas, they were evacuated. Lenin's embalmed corpse, that was evacuated.
I did think as I was reading your book that you took a risk because you didn't know what pianos you would find. I imagine you thought... I imagine you didn't think of telling so much incredible history when you set off to find those pianos. This was truly a book that evolved as you went, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that's really, I'm really glad you felt that from reading it because it was exactly that. I was taking a huge chance, but I've always known that I write best when I feel something. I have a response, and sometimes that risk, it's a feeling of risk, a bit of jeopardy, either being a tiny person in a huge physical space or a very severe climate or in a difficult geopolitical situation, whatever it might be. But I need to feel something to be able to write. And that's why Siberia felt just like this thing that was giving me this big open potential to, and there's nothing new under the sun. There's no exploring left to be done. And this gave me a feeling that maybe I had a lens on the world that could make me feel things for the first time, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. What you didn't know was that you would find such great stories. I think you call it the greatest storytelling area of the world. That would have been your profound discovery too.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the incredible thing about Russia is the high level of education. And that's one of the great legacies of the Soviet period. I mean, it is amazing. You knock on a door in the middle of nowhere and you think there is nothing here. There is nothing here except for an alcohol problem. The very opposite, you know, they can talk classical music. They can talk Pushkin. They can talk poetry. It's just such a high level of education. For somebody who's an interviewer and like myself, trying to gather stories to report, that's just gold. Yes, I found it incredibly hard at times to keep on going, but ultimately the returns were just so huge. And one of the main things, actually, which I think is important to say, is it gave me a different appreciation of time and space. You know, in my own culture, I'm English, you can hear, and everything's run off an iPhone and we're all like running, never have time for anything except what is scheduled into our lives. I would knock on a door in the middle of nowhere. It was a foreign woman with an interpreter and a great friend, a photographer. And we'd say, have you got a piano? And time and space changed. It was a piano was like a passport. It was like this incredible connector. The door would open and I didn't know if I'd be there for 1 hour or 3 days. And that was so magical because it doesn't happen to me in other places where I've worked or in the place from which I'd come.
Why were those Siberian pianos, so many of them, left to rot then?
Well, I think they've, you know, if I went looking for pianos in my local village in England, I'd probably find them rotting too, you know. Yeah. But at the end of the day, they're an instrument. They're a tool to music. And if somebody has looked after that tool, there's a reason for it. Not because it's the most expensive, grandest label in the world, but because it mattered to them. Mm. And that's what I was looking for.
Cold so extreme it makes your tears freeze into the lines around your eyes. But it means you can see the footsteps of the tiger in the snow. There was a priest in the times of the Tsar who wore a tiger's skin under his cassock to avoid being bitten by the town dogs. That's in your book. I wonder if that worked. I wonder if that worked for him.
I was with a tiger researcher, a pretty humble guy in the Far East outside Khabarovsk, and a professional tiger conservationist, according to one very brilliant expert, is lucky to see a wild tiger once or twice in their lives. There's 500, around 500, maybe a few more now because the conservation work is doing very well, but of these creatures left in the world, they're huge, huge, huge tigers. And I was there, it was my first trip to this region, right at the beginning in March 2016 when I kind of started. And we turned a corner and there was a tiger lying in the middle of the track. It was the most extraordinary thing. And this tiger saw us, we saw it. It slowly got up. There was absolutely no fear to its movement. It was such an overwhelming experience. And you could see the snow falling off its back. It was just, it felt like time had stopped. And it very amusing because this great friend of mine, this photographer, Michael, who was with me, he shoots on film. He doesn't shoot digital. So he was changing his roll of film when this happened. The tiger disappeared without his photo being taken. And we had this moment. And then we went and looked, and there was, you know, there was spots of blood. There was golden hair lying in the snow. And that was a moment, you know, maybe there was an element of craziness to it. But I thought, golly, if I can be fortunate enough and lucky enough and to find a wild tiger in Siberia, then surely I can find an old piano.
Yeah. No, it was that moment that embedded your determination regarding the pianos, which I thought was really interesting. If piano music runs through Russian veins like blood, you find, because we're talking tidbits now, but I think they're illustrative tidbits. You find proof of that allegiance to music when you meet some priests in Tobolsk.
Yeah, that was wonderful. So Tobolsk is a really, it's like the picture perfect Siberian Russian town that people dream of in the fairy tales. You know, I saw it under snow, beautiful kind of slow, big falling flakes, and this wonderful citadel. It's built on a high escarpment, and it's got all the kind of pretty colored domes that you'd expect of your sort of picture perfect Russia. And I was working there, I was looking for a particular piano, one of the last ones that the Romanov family played when they were under house arrest during their Siberian time at the end of their lives. And out of nowhere, he was a former priest, started to help me. And he was highly informed. He was very generous. He took me to the top of the bell tower. He took me round town. We were looking. And at the end of the day, I didn't do very well. And I was feeling pretty down about it and thought, oh, this piano thing's not going to work. And he said, oh, come and listen to this. And we went into the seminary. It's the oldest seminary in Siberia. And he had a group of friends, a choir, and they sang. And they sang in the canteen. I think there was probably about 10 of them. And it was utterly, utterly transporting. It was, they sing in, there's no instrumental music, they just sing. And it was, I don't know how to explain, it was the hairs on the back of my arms and a lot more besides. And I realized then that if music could move me and if there was this passion for it among the people, I had to keep on going. So it was moments like that when my confidence dropped and then something would flick the switch and make me think I could got to keep on going.
There is such a contrast in the delicate and fragile music of Siberia and the rough and harsh, sometimes terrible reality of life there for so many. Why did so many talented and musical people end up there in the 1830s?
Well, this is the Decembrist uprising. Some people call it the first Russian Revolution. It was in 1825, and there was a group of spectacular, 100 odd, spectacularly brave gentlemen who sought to bring down the Tsarist regime. And they were the glittering noble families and the intelligentsia. And it failed spectacularly. And they were banished to Siberia with vengeance by the Tsar, because these were people that one of them in particular was a childhood friend. And so off they went to the silver mines of Siberia. And with them went their loving wives in pursued, not all the wives, but the loving wives. And among them was a woman called Maria Volkonsky, who, again, she sort of fulfills a sort of very romantic part of Siberia's history. And she followed alone sometime after her husband. I think it was about a year after her husband. And she carried with her on the back of her sledge her clavichord, small piano. And she took it over a frozen Lake Baikal. I mean, the biggest, deepest lake in the world. Holds a fifth of the world's fresh water. And you imagine this princess in her furs kind of galloping across the ice to be with her husband. And eventually they're together and she moves the piano into his jail. And then after the labor sentence was up, they lived in the city of Irkutsk, beautiful city, close to Baikal. And there she ran music salons like she did back in Moscow and Petersburg. And there's a piano that you can find there now in the Volkonsky family home, now a museum. It's a Lichtenthal, and it's a spectacular instrument. This Maria Volkonsky inspired the poetry of Pushkin, Tolstoy. It's a rich, rich narrative. But she had an enormous effect, as did some of the fellow Decembrists, as they were called, on the musical culture of Siberia thereafter.
Irkutsk, the Paris of Siberia, although Chekhov didn't think much of it. What do you think of it today?
Look, I mean, all these places are... Parts of them are beautiful. I really enjoy the church architecture and some of the old wooden architecture, and parts of them are ghastly. You know, they're rough. And I experienced all the extremes. So it's not like an aesthetic experience, Siberia. It's a different thing. I mean, the landscapes blow my mind, you know, it's just the scale. I mean, I guess you're used to them in New Zealand, but, you know, I come from a really small country, so with a lot of fences. And to go into those fenceless landscapes on that scale is, like, pretty profound in this day and age. But, yeah, I liked Irkutsk.
The Lost Pianos of Siberia, and we're talking with Sophie Roberts. So the piano in your book isn't just a motif, a hook to hang a history on, but a vital way into that history. And that is how I think your book has become what people are calling one of the great travel books of recent times. But let's talk about a couple of specifics. I know we can't go into all the pianos you hunted down or tried to hunt down, but part of your book is the sheer violent history of Russia and the Soviet Union over the last few hundred years. And there is the piano in that house in Ekaterinburg where the family of the last Tsar were held by the Bolsheviks until the Midnight Massacre in 1918. You tried to locate that piano.
Yeah, I did. I needed to understand the key moments in the history of Siberia. After the murders, the White Army went in to gather evidence. And one of the things left, a lot of it had been thrown into the fire. You know, a lot of their treasures and personal things had been thrown into the fire, any evidence. But not the piano. The piano still stood. And so it's in the official inventory. So it was a bit of a wild goose chase, but I thought it worth a pop. And I tried to find that piano. And in so doing, and it's a classic example of why this lens, if you like, worked for me. It might not work for every reader, but it worked for me because it allowed me to dig into this history by searching for the piano to really feel the horror and violence of a really, really dark moment in that country's history, all because of a piano.
Yeah. And you seek as well the Novosibirsk Steinway, which the Leningrad Philharmonia in exile might have played. Do you find pianos that would have been in the gulags, recent pianos played by famous musicians? Somewhere near Tomsk, you find the 19th century Bechstein belonging to a woman named Olga Leonidova.
Remember just that August, name, right? Olga's good.
Yeah. That's supposed to be the best piano in Siberia. Which would you say is the best one you located and the one you liked locating most?
Yeah, you see, that's a really tricky question because the best to me is such a confluence of different things. You know, it's story, it's the people that told the story, and it's the survival. It's not always just the sound.
Sure.
And I suppose there was one that I was really excited by because it was the needle in the haystack, and it was in Khabarovsk. And right when I'd seen the tiger right at the beginning, I was told by a piano tuner who was key. The piano tuners of Siberia were absolutely key to my hunt, you know, because they tune them, so they know them. And this gentleman had told me about a pretty special piano that he believed had come to Siberia on a sledge in the late 19th century. And it was with a family in Khabarovsk who'd bought it for $100 during perestroika, when people were offloading their possessions in order to, you know, get through these horrific years of change. And I found the piano, but I couldn't find the provenance. I couldn't go back any further. So I used, I went on Russian television, and it was absolutely extraordinary. We got a telephone call, and it was from an ex-husband of the piano's owner, and we tracked it down. Russia makes you feel really superstitious. Like, you find a tiger's, you know, you see a tiger in the snow. And then on the second last day in Russia, when my visa was about to run out, you get a call saying, I know that piano. You get superstitious. You start to believe strange things. Yeah. It's kind of magic. That was a really special instrument. The sound is not good, but the story was remarkable.
In World War II, so many people and objects headed east, partly for safekeeping. And you certainly roamed. I'm whizzing through a bit of your book now, but there are two New Zealand connections, albeit one of them is small. It's the Siberian husky Osman, which ended up in the Wellington Zoo, which I found interesting bit of information. I suppose we'd better tell people why.
Yeah, no, that's a great story about Captain Scott, who was going down, you know, on the 1911 attempt on the South Pole. And they hired their team of huskies and dog handler from this remote bit of Siberia. You know, they were the best dogs and the toughest men. And this gentleman, Dmitry Girov, went down with his Sakhalin huskies. And they were part of the search party that found Scott when he perished. And his favorite dog, Osman, lasted out the rest of his life in a New Zealand zoo. But there was another really significant New Zealander in my story.
Yes, Rodney Russ.
Rodney Russ, who was quite amazing. And I wanted to go to the Commander Islands and the Kurils, where I had a couple of piano leads, and which are this sort of, I call it where kind of, you know, it's like the last final ellipsis where Russia runs out entirely, these little dots that, you know, running into the Pacific before you hit North America. And I was struggling to find a way in. You know, they're quite difficult permissions and et cetera, et cetera. And lo and behold, there's a New Zealander called Rodney Russ who knows this part of the world like nobody else. Mm. And he runs birding expeditions down there. And I went down on one of his ships and we cruised through the Kurils and the Commanders. And in his cabin, he had just the most amazing collection of books on Siberia. I mean, Ben and I found in any British library. Including this encyclopedia that was about 4 inches thick in the English language on the history of Siberia. And I'm very grateful to the Kiwis.
I'm glad we could help. I better wind it up, but a strong sense of dystopia accompanied some of the pianos you found, because you found they'd lost their meaning without knowing their provenance, didn't you? I wonder if we still care about pianos. We do about yours as we read your book, but as a symbol of culture as much as we did once. What do you think?
Well, no. The truth is it was replaced by the synthesizer when I was a child.
Yeah.
It's gone. But it's not to say the meaning of the object is gone. And that's what I liked. There was a book that really influenced me in this by Edmund Duval. He wrote a book called The Hare with the Amber Eyes. And it's about, he uses an object in order to tell a much, much bigger narrative. And he had a line that, and when I read this, it kind of really got me going. And I thought, maybe this is what I can do. You know, objects have always been carried, sold, bartered, stolen, retrieved and lost. People have always given gifts. It's how you tell their stories that matters. And I think that really got to the core of what I wanted to do with this. So, yes, there's dystopia. Yes, there's horror. Yes, there's joy. But all of that I was able to tell through a search for a piano.
And tell very well. Yeah, there was certainly horror. What a dreadful tale of butchery the murder of the last Tsar was. It was the Tsarina who played the grand piano that mysteriously disappeared, didn't she?
The daughters.
the daughters as
yes,
well.
Yes,
yeah.
The daughters, yeah. And yeah, I mean, it was an important part of their lives. And it was, and the idea of a piano provides great, you know, music provides solace, just like the television does now, you know. It's, that's what's happened. The television has replaced the piano in the parlour.
Congratulations on the book. What a thing to embark on and to succeed in and complete. And, gee, this book must feel like a major achievement to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a lot of work, and it's, Siberia is a bit bigger than I thought.
Author said Siberia was a bit bigger than I thought. Sophie, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Jim.
Sophie Roberts.